It is March 20th, Tuesday, here at here in Austin. I guess it's March 20th almost everywhere. We came back from spring break. It was last week we were not in the studio because we were on spring break. And Wes, how was your spring break?
Oh, my spring break was good. I went to Florida with my girlfriend's family and a family friend of theirs and their 7-odd children. So that was eventful and full of childish joy on the behalf of both adults and children. I had a bad date with a skimboard, but a great date with my girlfriend, in which I sprained my wrist.
Oh.
Sprained or fractured, I don't feel like paying medical costs to find out. So overall, I'm gonna rate it a good vacation. Not restorative, but definitely a lot of fun.
That's good. Yeah, I went back home to California and just sat there for 1 week because everyone else was off, during college, because UT has a spring break that's like not lined up with the other colleges.
Mm, right. Yeah. So there's I've got a buddy that's at Berkeley out there, so they're still like doing full time class, and then next week, right?
I think it's next week they'll be the spring break for them. But whatever, you can't choose everything.
So. Right.
Anyways, while we were gone, there was a lot of news, like everywhere. I mean, whether it was here at UT Austin or Austin just generally and, nationally. So we wanted to cover it all today, try to get it all done. We have 2 hours today, which is nice because, well, I guess it's okay. I mean, the DJ after us, unfortunately, is suffering from food poisoning, so that's unfortunate. But we will cover that shift. We wanted to discuss first, we wanted to discuss UT Austin's news specifically. Specifically, this email that I've received from Greg Fenves suggesting that they're... Well, not suggesting, but indicating that they are going to raise tuition again. We wanted to cover that and explain what's behind that. And then we also wanted to talk about Rexit. Tillerson, the Secretary of State, fired, which is really unprecedented. I mean, to fire your Secretary of State... and who's going to be replacing him, which is the CIA director, Mike Pompeo, and who's going to be replacing the CIA director, Gina Haspel. I wanted to discuss all that. And then we wanted to talk about the McCabe firing, which also happened. Andrew McCabe, I think number 2 at the FBI.
Deputy director.
Yeah, who was fired days before he was going to get his pension, or eligible for his pension.
26 hours, almost a singular day before, yeah.
Yeah, and then, there's that. And then also I wanted to talk about some other sort of minutia, what the Democrats have been up to. There's this banking bill that was recently passed by the Senate that I wanted to discuss. And also the fact that the Democrats have backed away from DACA with their negotiations regarding the omnibus package. And if we have time, there's the Cambridge Analytica story, which is really, you know, the talk of the town in the mainstream media, and then the opioid crisis, Donald Trump's solutions, which involve death penalties for drug dealers, which is pretty strange. We'll go into that and other things like that. And I guess we can go right into it because I've already finished all the stuff that we need to do.
Let's do it.
So I wanted to talk about the UT Austin email that we got just when we came back from spring break. I mean, this is a long, tiring spring break, and we're coming back, and we're going to be starting to study, and we get this, you know, small email slipped in from Greg Fenves, who's the president of UT Austin, and it's a very, well, it's pretty remarkable how clunky and tone deaf this email is. So over the past week, I think Austin has been suffering this kind of, this sort of bomber that's been sending out, you know, really mail the packages in the mail, and it's like been killed 4 people.
There have been a series of 4 bombings. The first 2 seem to be actually placed on their doorstep, so not sent in the mail, and there was a hypothesis kind of going around that it was minority based or ethnicity based bombings. And then the second one involved a tripwire, and seriously injured two men. And so they kind of have been recrafting that theory. And then just yesterday, or I guess was it today, that a FedEx shipment in San Antonio blew up that was routed for Austin, and they have yet to confirm or deny whether it is directly involved or linked to the Austin bombings, but I think there's a strong suspicion. So we've been seeing a kind of rash of, a rash of bombings in Austin. Two people have died and two others are severely injured.
Yeah, and I think for a while people were thinking it was like a hate crime thing because they were targeting, or at least the bombs initially were targeting, I think, people who were like minorities. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know what the consensus on that is. But yeah, so that's been happening for the past week, which is, I mean, pretty devastating and pretty dangerous. I mean, you know, it's obviously scary. And I think one of the people that was killed was actually accepted into the School of Music here at the university, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, yeah. I think that was the bomb, the second bomb that happened there in Riverside. Real tragedy. I didn't see that information about that student being accepted to UT, but it's a shame.
Yeah, so in the midst of this, right, Greg Fenves sends an email, right, where the subject is, I'm going to raise tuition, right? And he slips this, you know, little paragraph of condolences about the Austin bombing, the situation that's been happening. And then he says, oh, by the way, we're also increasing your tuition by, I think it was 2%, right? Which is what the recommendation was, which is not insignificant, by the way. I don't know. The first thing right off the bat, I would think, maybe you would send two separate emails, you know, one email addressing the Austin bombing and one email addressing the tuition increase. But that's the least of my problems with the whole situation, because I think I covered this last semester as well. And not a lot of people know that the University of Austin, the UT system, has a huge endowment in the form of this $20 billion oil fund. So it's not really an endowment per se, but the way UT was, back like when UT was created, they bought, I think it was 2.1 million acres of land, right? And that's they found that there was oil there. And I think this year, because, well, in 2011, I think there were, since 2011, because there was a huge oil boom, right? They've been able to get a lot of oil extracted from that area. And so this last year, I think, from my, you know, limited research on this issue, I read this thing about this in the Texas Tribune, which is one of the newspapers here, and the what's it called, the Daily Texan also covered it once. But basically, it's a $20 billion fund. They have, I think, since 2017, they've had $20 billion, and they can't take all of it out, right? They have to take a little bit of it. That's what an endowment is, right? So this past year, let me pull it up. This past year, right? So in 2011, right, they got $352 million from the fund, right? 2017, they get $603 million, half of which flows to UT Austin automatically. So the way it works is basically they spend whatever they can for the $603 million, and anything else after that goes directly to UT Austin, no questions asked. Because right, that's their flagship program. I mean, so typically about half of it goes to UT Austin, right? And so what UT has done, right, with this $19.5 billion, right, they take $603 million out of it. They give $298 million to UT Austin. Mm-hmm. And of that, $38 million goes to financial aid, right? Which is, I mean, it's like it's a fraction of how much money they're giving to admin, which is $111 million went to UT system admin, $148 million went to capital projects like construction, right? So, and of the $38 million they give to financial aid, $3 million goes to undergraduate students, right? Now, all of this is is interesting. I mean, people might say, okay, $3 million, that's a lot of money, and Fenves can make the argument. I think he has made the argument that, you know, UT gets a lot of financial aid compared relative to other universities. Or, I mean, I haven't really assessed that claim, but that might be true, conceivably, considering how much money they have. But the problem is that the way that they've been spending money for the past few years with this chancellor, I mean, Chancellor Bill McRaven is the chancellor of the UT system. He has spent money in such a very irresponsible way. And let me just give you some examples, right? So they spent $215 million, right? They spent $215 million buying 300 acres of land in Houston, empty land, right? And they literally had no idea what they were going to do with it, right? Bill McRaven, when he became chancellor, came out and he said, I'm going to have 9 quantum leaps, he called them. This the quantum leaps. We're going to revitalize education in the UT system. One of the big planks of that was to buy this land in Houston, right? And he had no idea what he was going to do with it, but he presents it to the region, says, okay, you know, I'm going to buy this $215 million of land, and we're going to develop there, right? And everyone's understandably, I mean, the regents were all happy. They unanimously approved it. They were ecstatic because obviously it's not their money that they're wasting. They're using taxpayer money. They're using the students' money, right? But then obviously there was some backlash from the Texas Senate, right? And eventually, after a lot of public outcry, in fact, the Daily Texan, I think, wrote something about it. Because of the public outcry, eventually he had to say, okay, I'm backing away from this deal. I mean, they already bought the land. They bought the $215 million, the land. And they said, I want to resell it, right? And so that process is still happening. But right off the bat, that's $215 million that they wasted, right? And Bill McRaven, actually, because one of the reasons he's resigning in May is because of that. I mean, he cites health reasons, but it's mostly because of the backlash, because of this ridiculous plan, right? Then, okay, that's $250 million, right? And then there's $100 million that they spent over the past few years on this, you know, in-house education startup, right? This technology startup. It's MOOCs, right? Online courses, massive online courses, right? They spent $100 million on this institute, right? It's called the Institute of Transformational Learning. And they pumped in $50 million. And then Bill McRaven, that was before Bill McRaven came in. Then he said, actually, we need to pump in more money into that. And so they pumped in another $48 million, right? And the thing about this online institute, right? I take online courses. It's not a problem. But the problem with this is that UT students, first of all, it's absolutely free. Anyone can use it, right? So they're not getting any revenue from it. Number two, UT students and people in the UT system can't get credit for that. Like, they can't even, like, it's not admissible as credit. So it's really not for them, like, obviously, right? And so, I mean, it's just so irresponsible. I mean, and eventually they had to shut it down because it was so, they were spending so much money that they recently just shut it down. 50 employees they had in this Institute of Transformational Learning. I don't know what the 50 employees were doing, but they shut it down and they laid off all of those people, right? And then finally, of course, they had the $141 million. Bill McRaven spent $141 million building this really fancy office tower in downtown Austin, like 17 stories tall, and it gives hundreds of employees. They get this nice new building. They already have 5 buildings, by the way. Yeah. They get this nice giant building, right? And so I'm just thinking all this money is being spent on these projects that are, I mean, they're not for the students. These are all, you know, administrative costs. These are all, you know, they're investing money in, you know, startups. And in fact, other smaller, you know, action items that I'm also concerned about. He spent $1 million on a study, not on a study to figure out how to brand the UT system, right? So not like he was like, okay, we need to figure out how to brand UT. And so they spent $1 million on a study to figure out how to brand UT Austin. I don't know what kind of study needs $1 million, but they did that, right? And all of this is in the justification is because we want to increase UT's ranking. We want to increase UT's college ranking, and that means we have to invest in really world-class faculty and in take up all these endeavors and stuff like that. And we also can't take much money out of the endowment, right? Because the way college rankings work is if you take money out of the endowment, then that actually has an effect on the college ranking. And so to justify all this, they have to increase the tuition, which remarkably doesn't have any impact on the college ranking. And so it's just remarkable. And by the way, Greg Fenves has also not been really frugal with the money that he's been. First of all, he gets $1 million as salary. I don't know what he gets with that $1 million. Second of all, there was this recent scandal of him. I'm sure you've heard of the thing about him using first class and business class flying around.
Yeah, I saw that. The Daily Texan broke that a couple weeks back. I think I saw that he repatriated $27,000, was it, into the UT system. I mean,
that's only because he got caught, right? And so, you know, it's just, I mean, I think that when people get upset, right, there was this recent, you know, spray painting thing that happened in the Littlefield fountain, right? And people were like, understandably, like, oh, this person's damaging school property. Or like, you know, there have been protests near the pharmacy building regarding that Richard Morissette thing. I mean, I just don't think that the students have any representation. I mean, what else can you do when you're given this kind of situation where you have, you know, this case where they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on these kinds of projects, and then they're asking students to pay that cost, right? I mean, take the money out of that. Take the money out of your own pocket, right? The $1 million that Bill McRaven gets for just doing nothing, right? Or the $1 million that Greg Fenves gets. I mean, I'm sure they do something, right? But they haven't justified that salary, in my opinion. They haven't justified all this waste, right? And it's just, it is remarkable, I think. And it also, I also hold the student government culpable. The Daily Texan less so because they actually cover this kind of thing.
Right.
But I mean, to be frank, if you ask me, I mean, the Daily Texan is a student publication. This should be the front page news, right? That they're increasing tuition. Why are they increasing tuition? They've gotten, you know, $200 million, you know, $20 billion oil fund. Instead, the front page news is about the student government fiasco, right? Whereas, what has the student government done in regards to this? They've done nothing. They haven't even. I don't even know if they've passed a resolution in support of not increasing tuition, but they haven't done anything of consequence.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult because this is such a multifaceted situation. Part of the problem here is a way that nationally that we think about higher education and institutions of higher education. So the idea that part of a college's rank and part of a college's certification in America is based on their kind of institutional system. So how many buildings they have, whether they have gyms available for the students. It's all these kind of things that are pertinent to student life, but in theory extraneous to education. And so increasing those extraneous expenses, as I would classify them, is a way to kind of help boost your rank and as a way to help colleges boost their kind of esteem nationwide. And those have a place, obviously. When you have, you know, 50,000 students in a location, there should be amenities for them, there should be student services. But the idea that we need to expand our rank at the expense of education just doesn't seem warranted on its face. And then to extract that cost from the students.
Yeah.
There's a lot of parts that kind of are babbling within myself on this situation, because I have the perennially unpopular opinion that college has become too cheap, and it's difficult to justify the idea that grade or degree inflation means that too many people are actually going to college for what they get out of it and what society gets out of it. But that doesn't mean the way of doing that, you know, the way of defending against that is to make the education more rigorous and better for the student. And that doesn't mean that you put the costs on the student consumer. And so what they're doing to me seems backward. And the justification for it that they give, you know, inflationary cost and the supporting their world-class faculty, it's warranted and it's fair. But in the light of the kind of other spending measures that you have cited here, it just seems that they are putting the kind of the onus on the wrong individuals here.
And I mean, here's the thing, right? Other universities like Harvard and Yale, they have huge endowments too, right? They are private universities, mm-hmm. right? This is a public university. It's at least supposed to pretend that they care about the students, okay? And, you know, when you have a situation where 56% of the UT Austin, you know, student body is of the top 20% in terms of income in the Texas area, right? I mean, the whole point of public universities is that it's supposed to propel people who are in this, you know, cycle of poverty, right? Get them out of this situation, put them in education, right? And that one of the components of that is financial aid, which seems, compared to the massive amount of money they're willing to spend on risky investments, right? And by the way, limited transparency on that too, right? Because, I mean, when was the last time UT Austin students heard about that, right? I mean, most people don't even know that, right? So there's that. And then they have this miserly, like, you know, $3 million given to undergraduate students here at the university. It's just, I mean, there needs to be some kind of, like, I saw an infographic that really explains the whole situation, right? Now, you know, in the past, it used to be 36% of the money came from the state, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it was 9% came from the student body.
Right.
That's flipped now. So now it's like 36% of it comes from the student body. This is not a public university anymore. This is increasingly becoming more privatized. And you can make an argument for that. You can make a thing about vouchers and stuff like that. But then don't pretend that this is any kind of public institution that cares about its students, that doesn't want to make, you know, a profit, right? It's remarkable. And what else is remarkable is that no one talks about it. No one wants to discuss it. No, it's like this kind of open secret. These public universities, they increase tuition and it's becoming less and less affordable, right? And student debt is a huge problem. Instead, everyone wants to talk about other things when it comes to college, right? They want to talk about, oh, affirmative action, right? Affirmative action is the big thing that's happening right now in the college campuses. I mean, when you go around in these political circles, they'll talk about, oh, affirmative action, right? Because we can't have, you know, racist policies, right? That's what the whole thing is, racist mm-hmm. policies. As if that's the only sort of policy that uses race. We can't have minorities, we can't have people who are black people or brown people, we can't have them coming into college without really scrutinizing and really making sure that it's happening, right? There was a Supreme Court case about this regarding UT Austin, right? Whereas affirmative action, by the way, it's only used for tie-breaking, right? So right. We make an argument about affirmative action, right? But it has to be put into context, right? We have to put this into context. When the university is wasting all this money, when the university gives a bunch of preference to alumni, right? Alumni preferences, no one talks about that. No one cares that if your dad or grandfather has this tennis court named after him on the university, you just get in automatically, right? No one wants to talk about, there was a recent scandal under Bill McRaven's watch where 73 students who didn't even perform well, right? They performed under the, like, their grades and stats were really, really bad. But they got some letter of rec from the UT speaker of the, like, from the Texas Speaker of the House or like a UT quarterback or something like that. They got in, right? There was a Daily Texan opinion article about this, mm-hmm. right? This was not front page news. It was an opinion article. There's zero comments on it on the website, right? So no one cares about this when it's, frankly, I think, I mean, I'm not a libertarian, but if you want to talk about public waste, this is the best way to talk about it, right? This is the best sort of issue because there's no oversight. There's nothing. It's just remarkable. And then they want students to foot the bill.
Right. Yeah. And it's exactly like you said, the public waste issue. And I'm not terribly well versed on the kind of administrative side of this. I haven't done probably my due diligence for the kind of economics regarding the UT system. But the idea that people are focusing on the wrong issues, I think, is exactly the correct point to make. you know, we're focused on whether they're profiling based on race or you know, based on income, based on gender, based on anything.
Yeah.
But we're not focused on whether they're, you know, profiling based on merit. You know, the idea that when students who are academically inclined get the most from college and benefit the society the most. And so, I mean, let's just look at, you know, UT's mission statement, transforming lives to benefit society. You know, if we're going, if they're going to make any attempt to be true to that statement, the notion that we, you know, and one of the arguments here that bothers me the most is it's relative to the total cost of tuition, it's not that big an increase, but it affects people on the margin. It's about the person who's extremely well qualified, but is not qualified for, you know, student merit-based scholarships, which, gotta be honest, that's a difficult pool. You know, those people shouldn't be edged out because they are less able to afford college, but, you know, more able in terms of merit than somebody who can afford the next marginal $420 over 2 years. And so if we're going to be genuine to the kind of mission statement that we've got here at UT, raising tuition rates at this level, and part of it is, like you said, the allotments or the allocations from the state have been decreasing steadily and almost correlative, almost directly correlative to the tuition increases.
Yes.
Kind of switch around there. It really challenges the notion of what role the states have to play in public education. Because if we're going to, you know, have these public higher education institutions, they really should be genuine to their mission statement.
Yeah.
You know, I come from the libertarian perspective of if it's there, regardless of whether I want it to be there, if it's there, let's run it efficiently.
Yeah.
You know, and so what we're doing with this system is really edging out people who would be qualified and who would gain the most from college education, who would, you know, pay that back later in life from their college education. We're edging them out in favor of students who can afford it, which is inherently an arbitrary measure of merit.
Yeah.
The economic wealth of your parents is not a strong, I mean, it's a strong predictor of how you're going to be educated, but not a strong predictor of how you're going to, you know, succeed and be intelligent and merit-based. And so it's one of these things is, you know, if it's going to be a public institution, let it be a public institution. And we can have the debate about whether that public institution should be there. But if it's there, run it efficiently, try to be true to your statement.
I mean, this whole spending spree was really started in 2011. So what happened in 2011 was that Governor Rick Perry of Texas comes out and he says, you know what, we have a huge deficit that I'm kind of responsible for because I promised I wasn't going to raise taxes on anybody. So what we're going to do is what we always do, which is austerity, which means we're going to cut public institutions, like we're going to cut money for education. They sucked $500 million out of the school budget, right, the public education budget. And we're also going to cut Medicare, Medicaid, all that stuff. You know, people who need that sort of thing, oh, you're on your own, sort of, right? And so that's what he did, right? And studies have recently come out about how damaging that has been to elementary schools, let alone, you know, universities and stuff like that, about, you know, turnovers and furloughs and, you know, smaller class sizes. Anyways, so I mean, there needs to be a point made that, you know, like you said, right? I think the problem with education in this country and the way people perceive it is that it really is one of the longest term investments you can make in a society. You don't see the immediate costs come back to you, right? When you put someone through the education system, right, it takes 18 years before they can, you know, start ostensibly come back and become a benefit to the economy or whatever, right? But once they do come back, once they become higher, you know, better skilled or whatever, then it's profoundly better, right, as compared to if they didn't have a college education, if they didn't have a high school education, how much money they could help the economy, right? And so we have to think of it in that way. We have to think of it in that context as well. And we have to think about it, I just think it's also a matter of like a moral context as well. I mean, when you have people who are, you know, in this cycle, right, of like poverty, right? They're not able to get out of it. Education is the one of the ways you can get out of it, right? And the fact that we have enough money, right? We have the $212 million to buy that land. That money could have been spent like on getting those people back into the education system, right? Like, I mean, I'm not saying it's a direct correlation, right? We couldn't take all the $212 million, but some of that money could have been used, right? Mm. And that's, I mean, the job of the institution of learning is to teach the students. It's not sports, right? It's not to make this giant sports merchandise that destroys student athletes. That's another thing, by the way. And it's not to, you know, pad the pockets of the Regents Board or invest in these startups, like these weird, this is not a company, this is a public institution that shouldn't be making these kinds of risky investments without consulting the student body. But the fact is, they don't care, right? They don't care. And surprisingly, I mean, the one person who was talking about this during the 2016 election was Donald Trump. In Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, he comes out and he says, you know what, I think that a lot of these universities are spending their giant endowments on things that aren't helping the students, right? And so we want to make that go towards student debt. And that was that was a pretty interesting thing he said. And I didn't even know that he had said that. And then in this recent tax bill, right, there were certain things that they had proposed, which included, I think, something about the graduate students, right? None of that got passed.
Obviously. Well, in some version of education tax got passed. I actually read an article that I never got up in time to be topical. So none of the kind of concentrated cost on students in terms of taxes, so the kind of tax on graduate student tuition allotments never got passed. But some of the taxation on merchandise for institutions, so the idea that the profit they make off the branding, that did get taxed. And then they couldn't, and this could actually potentially come back and affect UT quite a bit with some of the business deals that we've, so all of their affiliated businesses have to be separate, so they can't take the losses in business venture that they have on the side and put that towards their kind of net total. They have to be separate, so the tax would be paid there.
One thing that they did pass that was interesting was this excise tax that they put on endowments, right? So that only, so if you actually look into the details of that, it was like a 1.4% tax, which is pretty small, but it's a tax on the endowments, right? Because the endowments are donations, right? Right. They're considered donations, and so they're taxed. Typically they're considered tax-free, right? So they put a 1.4 tax on endowments, right? But it only applies to a certain amount of private universities, and the way that they've applied it, it's kind of strange because certain universities like Columbia would be exempt from it. Columbia University, with their $10 billion endowment, would be exempt from it. But then smaller, like liberal arts colleges, like Swarthmore, would be subject to it. And so people have been confused about this too. Like, why is this happening? And I think one of the primary driving factors for that was probably not to do with actually, you know, wanting to solve this problem. Because if they did, then they would go after, you know, Columbia or, you know, I don't even think Harvard is subject to them, right?
I can't remember. I think Harvard's was, I think it was affected by it, but I'm not entirely, I'll check.
Well, I mean, a lot of big universities were exempt from it. Right. And so I think, and a lot of people have been speculating, because the way that they're targeting liberal arts colleges like UChicago and stuff like that, it seems to be more of this kind of institutional attack on education that the Republicans have been coming up with for a long time, where they don't really see, or they attack higher education, right? And so that's where this sort of emanates from, and that's kind of what I think is the cause for that.
Yeah, and Harvard did it over. And the way that they praised it was that if the endowment constitutes more than $500,000 per student, which is why Columbia was exempt and Harvard got right. And obviously, you know, that has a diminishing return as they tax it, the per capita rate falls, and then they can fall under it. I mean, it's difficult because, as you said earlier, and I think I want to return to your point, the idea of what society gets from education. There are a lot of intangibles related to education, and those are difficult to measure. And I think, you know, in terms of the life gains, the kind of wellness gains from being an educated, well-rounded person, those I think are less apparent in college than I would see in high school. You know, the idea that educating a student up till 18 obviously does pay dividends in terms of wellness, in terms of their ability to work. But in college, it's really about whether the student is fit and academically, you know, fit for the college they're participating. A poor student in a rigorous college does not kind of gain the same that a fair student, a good student does, and does not return that to society. And so,
I mean, there is an argument to be made that, yes, certain students will not perform well in the colleges, and they've been forced in, right? Because the fact that every single job requires a degree, that's an interesting thing to point out. Another interesting thing is also, I mean, frankly, just, I mean, it does sound a bit harsh, but a lot of these majors that people get themselves into,
of course,
right, just aren't financially sustainable, and a lot of people don't really get, I mean, the amounts of jobs that there are in these majors, I'm not going to name specific ones, but there are certain majors where it's like the job market is really not fitting the amount of people going into them. And so that's where, you know, a lot of people talk about, okay, we should give subsidies for people to go to college and stuff like that, free college, things like that. You know, I'm pretty much like, I mean, that sounds nice in principle, and I do think that some things need to be made to make college more affordable, but we need to make sure that that money is not going to people who are going to be studying, you know, art history. Because, I mean, while I do like art history, I don't think that the amount of jobs available for art history, I mean, it just has to be realistic.
Right.
Are going to go to every single person who's applying.
Yeah, well, and it's difficult because it's the way that we accept candidates and the way that we accept students into these majors, it's a bit backwards. The idea that only the very, you know, academically rigorous kids at the top who are passionate about that topic and actually wanting to use that will get the kind of gain or return from that major. And yet we think of those as the majors that are easier to get into. So we've got it a bit backwards. Again, we have a strong system of private institutions. And so there are colleges for which the, you know, free market barriers to entry from just sheer cost are in effect. But if we're going to have public institutions, we ought to run them on a merit-based, you know, system. And part of that is difficult to kind of imagine how one, you know, actually puts that into practice. And it's difficult because, you know, even with just the top six, or I guess there was 7% when you and I applied.
Yeah, yeah.
And now it's been trimmed down to 6%.
Yeah.
Something like half of the spots at UT are based on just that, you know, just that acceptance, half or three quarters. And so,
well, see, here's the thing about the top 6%, and I do think that that is a bit deceptive, because when, and this happens in California too, I mean, I come from a place that was very, like, I mean, it was academically pretty rigorous, and it was, like, really, it was really tough, like, I mean, compared, relative to other places in California, right? And so, you know, a B in my high school wasn't considered, like, the end-all be-all, right? Whereas if you got a B in some other unit, like other high school in some other place, it might be considered really bad, because they knew that, okay, well, the teachers are harder and it's more rigorous here, and it's just the way of the land, right? And so what ends up happening is when you say top 6% of the school, right? Or the, I don't know how it's done, top 6% of the,
I think it's top 6% now, yeah.
Yeah, right? Top 6%, right? Well, the top 6% of some random school in the middle of nowhere will be very different from the top 6% in this urban area where, you know, a bunch of, like, where it's very high, very rigorous, right?
Right.
And so when you just say a top 6%, it's a bit hard to say that, because I mean, I do think that it also leads to kind of like location bias and location diversity, because when people are like, okay, we want this person from this school and this person from this region and this amount of people from this region, we want quotas, right? Because they do that.
Right, of course.
And so what you end up is that the areas, ironically, the areas where it's the most competitive, mm-hmm. people are screwed over the most.
Yeah, and that's the point I was going to go on to make, is the idea that, like, you know, I keep whinging about the merit-based, you know, the need for a merit-based system in these public institutions. But we, you know, ostensibly we have that, but the problem persists at the level below. The idea that not all of high schools in Texas have
the same kind of, yeah,
similar standards for what the top 6%. And so that's why I was trying to get at the point that it's like, it's difficult to conceive of what a merit-based, you know, process for admission would look mm-hmm. like, minus that, or, you know, sans that 6%.
And but, that, yeah, and this is a question of the standardized tests, for example,
right, of course.
Where it's been proven in studies where it's like, it's not as much a metric of intelligence, but more of a metric of how much tutoring can you really buy and how much sort of, there's a lot of correlation between the income you get, the income you have, the dispensable income you have, and the performance on your standardized mm-hmm. test. And so there's a question to say about, is that just another form of, you know, the income biopsy, where we just say, if you have this amount of money, then you're set. If you live in this area, if you live in this neighborhood, then you're set, because the property tax, the way it's funded, is property tax. So if you're in this neighborhood and you get a really nice school, if you're in this neighborhood, you don't get a really nice school.
Yeah, right. And I mean, it's difficult, and the kind of jumpstart for this, the tuition increases, really represents more of the same that we've been getting, and it hasn't been showing results.
Yeah.
Degree inflation is a real problem. The same job that required just a high school or a GED equivalent 50 years ago now requires, by and large, a college degree today. And it's we've had in our public institutions, we've had a financial based you know, system of admissions. The idea that part of it, you know, is obviously merit based, in that you can't pay for it if you don't get admitted in the first place. But, you know, a smart and capable student who is admitted but can't pay for it is just in the same boat as somebody who didn't get, you know, admitted to the college at all. The idea that they're still not gaining, yeah. and they're not benefiting to society. And if we're going to run these public institutions for, you know, social benefit, which, again, all of this is based on, you know, the acceptance of that argument, that's not, you know, given. That argument can be had, and that argument can be made. But if the institutions are there,
yeah.
they should be run efficiently, and they should be run for the kind of maximum gain to society. And so it's a very difficult, you know, answer, but obviously the answer is not extract the resources from the students at the, you know, and let the administration go spend willy-nilly on these needless and extraneous projects.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've spent a lot of time on this issue, I know that, but I want to eventually move to the Rex Tillerson thing, but I just want to make one final comment about, you know, all this talk about degree inflation and the student debt crisis that's looming, and the increase, like, the, you know, the privatization of the public institutions that are, like, the universities. All of this talk is, you know, done in these kinds of circles. But what are our leaders discussing right now? They're discussing whether we should arm teachers in public schools. They're discussing, you know, in it just it, there's no conversation. I mean, I don't think we can turn to Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education, for much guidance on this. So, anyways, I do want to move to one of the biggest stories of the past week, which was Rex Tillerson getting fired from the Celebrity Apprentice, sorry, the White House, the Trump administration. It was really almost fantastical, like a news story about how this guy was called back by John Kelly. He was in Africa at the time, mm-hmm. right? He was called back by John Kelly, come back to the U.S. And Rex Tillerson was like, why I don't come back to the U.S.? And they said, oh, well, you'll get a tweet, right?
Yeah.
And so he comes back, and because Rex Tillerson doesn't even have a Twitter, they had to print out the tweet and show him his his resignation letter, or his letter, and he got fired, and that's how he found out, right? Is that he got this tweet. So this is what American politics has become. We get people who are high ranking officials in the government are getting tweets as, you know, signals that they're fired. And by the way, that's never really, I mean, the idea that Obama would fire John Kerry or something like that, or even Bush firing his Secretary of State, like, there is a process to this. You gotta, you know, talk to that person, they have to offer their own resignation. No, he got fired, which is pretty strong. And now the now the person that's replacing him is CIA Director Mike Pompeo. And then who's going to be replacing CIA Director Mike Pompeo is Gina Haspel, who's the deputy director. And there's plenty to say about them. But I wanted to get your initial thoughts about Rex Tillerson. Why do you think he was fired? And what do you think of Rex Tillerson's tenure as Secretary of State?
Yeah, and look, it's I think that my heuristic for Trump has proven me just inexorably correct in this situation. The idea that he is at his core a showman that lives off the praise and you know, adulation of his fans and the dramatic flair of his presentation for all events. And so I think Rex Tillerson was fired in this way because of that. But the kind of fundamental reasons is his disagreements on the North Korea situation. The idea that Rex Tillerson represented the kind of diplomatic hand in the madman theory, the idea that Trump is kind of making all these boisterous moves and posturing and being very kind of belligerent in terms of North Korea, in terms of his position on North Korea, while Tillerson is doing the real diplomatic work.
Sure,
and part of that, you know, I think Trump really started to see that Tillerson... he started to see Tillerson as a person who was intent on kind of regulating his behavior, regulating his policies, his positions, the kind of nanny role. And Trump seems to be, I've read some pieces that have said that the guardrails are starting to come off.
Yeah, the idea that Trump he's losing his mind.
Right, well.
Or losing the so-called adults in the room.
Right, of course, that now, you know, in the first kind of year of his tenure, Trump was President Trump was quite, you know, afraid of the job, which, of course, you know, you're going into the most powerful position in the world. You should be afraid of the job. But now that he has become more comfortable and he has become more comfortable in giving his kind of unfiltered position on everything, he wants the people around him who agree with him to the fullest extent that is possible. And so Tillerson obviously is not that. I think Trump wants a more hawkish figure in the, which is bizarre because he ran on a kind of
the least
hawkish position in the Republican primary out of the field there. And I think it's really about attitude and the people around him that he wants to be completely comfortable and safe in voicing his totally unfiltered opinion and just have nods in the room. And Rex Tillerson obviously was not supplying that in any real capacity.
I mean, I think that, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I think that, first of all, I think that Rex Tillerson was already a horrible choice for Secretary of State.
Yeah.
He was an ExxonMobil scumbag. I mean, CEO of ExxonMobil. I don't know why he's given this sort of position, right? He has no prior experience, right? And he, during his tenure at Exxon, he violated sanctions, Russian sanctions. He got a $2 million fine, which is ludicrous. But so this is a typical, you know, corporate hack, right, who's being put into this position. But at least he was a basic businessman, right? He defunded the State Department, and there were so many positions in the State Department that were not filled, right? The ambassador to South Korea, all these sorts of really important positions, ambassador to Saudi Arabia, stuff like that, weren't filled, right? Now we can question about whether that was Tillerson not doing it or because he wasn't able to, but I mean, it just wasn't a big priority.
Well,
for him.
Yeah, and a lot of those positions weren't even susceptible to the kind of
political sort of
nomination process they were just not filled. He didn't do a good job of kind of managing down in his situation.
It was a complete the State Department was losing complete morale. I mean, it was a horrible situation, and the way he was managing it was terrible, right? It was atrocious. And also, I mean, he did have, he was less America first than right. Trump, right? So he did support the Paris Climate Accord. He called Trump and he was like, the idea of moving Jerusalem, the embassy to Jerusalem, is a terrible idea. Don't do that. He wanted to talk North Korea. He was in support of the Iran deal. Stuff like that, right? Because I think that Tillerson, at the end of the day, he is a businessman. But he, unlike Trump, he does understand contracts. And he understands, unlike Trump, who has run his businesses, like his administration, where he gets into a contract and then runs out at the last minute.
Right.
Tillerson was like, okay, we're in these deals. He was actually a negotiator. And so he was trying to talk to, you know, people who were ostensibly our enemies. And so, I mean, the fact that I'm feeling disappointed that Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, is out as Secretary of State is really disappointing, because the replacement, Mike Pompeo, is probably far worse, I think. I mean, first of all, Mike Pompeo is just a sort of a minion of Trump. One of the reasons that Trump even cited was that Mike Pompeo is basically agrees with me more than Rex Tillerson. And Mike Pompeo has some really dangerous kind of policy views, in my opinion. He's far more hawkish. You're talking about hawkishness. He's far more hawkish than Tillerson on a lot of these core, serious foreign policy issues.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think part of the dichotomy between these two individuals, Pompeo and Tillerson, is the way that you view the solution to declining American power on the world stage. The idea that, you know, the two solutions offered to someone who kind of is declining in power relative to the other world powers, you know, China, Russia. The first being the Tillerson way, the idea that we still participate in the global economy, we still participate in these contracts, we still participate in the kind of WTO.
Yeah.
And we honor our obligations to our allies, and just in a diminished capacity, we no longer have to be the top dog. Whereas Pompeo and Trump, I think, tend to be a more retractive, you know, isolationist force, where they think that the best way is to then focus internally and not even participate. You know, if we're not going to be the top dog, we're not going to be any dog in the fight. And so that's where I think that Pompeo kind of falls. And part of that is lip service to Trump. But it's difficult because, like you said, you know, I was listening to Political Gabfest, Slate's Political Gabfest, and I think the best way of describing my you know, feelings toward Tillerson is the food's terrible and I'm getting too little of it. You know, the idea that Tillerson was part of this triumvirate of General Kelly, General Mattis, and himself that, you know, agreed to be the kind of watchdogs in the room parenting over Trump's behavior. And so, you know, minus that, I think we're going to see a lot of a kind of more unguarded, unhinged, if you will, or unmoored from any kind of regard for the opinions of others. I think we're going to see a President Trump that follows those guidelines more. And that's something that I think, in terms of the kind of soft power of America, the kind of power that we project in non-military terms, is something that's going to really be detrimental. The idea that we cannot trust this man to honor his contracts in the same way that you couldn't trust him to honor his contracts. And I mean, it's, oh my God, I remember just like all of the people in my hometown, we need a businessman. Trump is the variant of businessman who puts profits at all, you know, way up here, and the social bonds of trust and contract far below.
Well, he's a snake oil salesman. He's always been. His businesses, first of all, a lot of his businesses failed miserably. And I mean, the casino was one of the casinos in Atlantic City. First of all, the phrase is the house always wins. I mean, the fact that you ran a casino and failed miserably at it, I mean, anyone with a half a brain could win in a casino, could run a casino properly. But anyways, that Trump's businesses and the fact that he still hasn't divested from them, that's a whole other thing. But yes, like you were mentioning, Rex Tillerson, I mean, this is the kind of absurdist political climate we live in now. Rex Tillerson, who, by the way, in 10, 15 years ago would have received so much criticism for the fact that he was an Exxon guy who violated Russian sanctions during his tenure, who knew about climate change. I mean, Exxon knew about climate change, but they still funded, like, internally they knew that it was happening, but they still funded people that were denying it. They still said that they denied it publicly. So stuff like that. And then also, when he became Secretary of State, there was a big, there was a minor scandal. I mean, it was a big scandal in my opinion, but a minor scandal in the grand scheme of things, given the Trump administration, that he was, the way he was divesting from ExxonMobil was buying all, getting all the stocks, right? But then he didn't pay any tax on that because he used a loophole. So he got out of $71 million of taxes by when he extracted the thing of ExxonMobil, because the way it works is that once you become a public official, there was some sort of loophole where you could claim, you know, money you get from the private, from the private sector, and you wouldn't get taxed on that and stuff like that. So there was a $71 million tax loophole that he just took advantage of, which is a scandal in and of itself. I mean, the guy who is supposed to be a public servant is not paying taxes. Ridiculous. But yes, Rex Tillerson on a lot of these issues was far more adamant than Trump. Take a look at the Russia situation. When he got fired, I mean, moments before he got fired, he agreed with Theresa May at the United Kingdom, who had said that Russia had poisoned that double agent, right, in Salisbury, right? Then, I mean, he was pretty strong on a lot of these issues. For example, the Myanmar, the ethnic cleansing that's happening right in Myanmar, he spoke out against that. When the UAE and Saudi Arabia tried to blockade Qatar, he tried to speak out against that. And then human rights abuses and military support to Egypt, given the human rights abuses, he actually wanted to speak out against that. I mean, it was just, he spoke out against it, right? It's just rhetoric. But the fact that he was saying that was encouraging from a soft power perspective. But Mike Pompeo, I mean, the guy, this guy is a loon, right? He's a radical Christian ideologue who is being put into this position of power. He, let's just go down the list. I mean, when he came to UT Austin, Mike Pompeo came to UT Austin, I went to that, actually, and I asked him a question. I asked him, what do you think of Edward Snowden, and what do you think about the revelations that he revealed? Because Mike Pompeo, it was pretty, like, it was one of these government buildings, not the government buildings, the school of government buildings. Right, yeah. Mike Pompeo came here. By the way, Rex Tillerson came here as well. I didn't go to that. But Mike Pompeo was there. At the time, he was a CIA director, and I asked him that. And then he said, well, Edward Snowden should be executed for what he did, and he's a traitor, and et cetera, et cetera. So this kind of crazy Russian rhetoric. When he was a congressman in Kansas, because remember, he was a congressman before he was CIA director, right? So I don't know why he was put in the CIA position in the first place. But when he was a congressman, he painted this picture. He ran as this anti-Islam, anti-anyone who is not white campaign. So, for example, in Kansas, his first election, he ran against this guy named Raj Goyal, who was an Indian, right? Indian-American person. And he goes around in Kansas saying, don't vote for the turban topper, vote American, right? And this is what he does. And then in Congress, when he's in Wichita in 2014, he talks about how the threat to America is from people who deeply believe Islam is the way, right? And so this is, you know, it is totally like he's a Christian crusader. I mean, he's a neo-Christian crusader who doesn't, who has, I mean, he's crazy. He's totally crazy. And also, I mean, the idea that he was good at the CIA, right? First of all, the CIA, there's a good foreign policy article aptly titled Good Riddance to CIA Director Mike Pompeo, because people at Langley are so happy that Mike Pompeo is gone, because Mike Pompeo, as CIA director, was really making a lot of political arguments.
Right.
So he'd go around and he'd try to defend Donald Trump's ludicrous statements about Russia and Russian interference. For example, he said that there's no evidence that the Russians interfered, or that, like, the intelligence agencies haven't confirmed that there's collusion, or not collusion, but that there's Russian interference, right? Which a spokesman had to later come back and say, oh, by the way, that's not true, by the way.
Yeah.
So he had a doomed tenure as CIA director, and now he's going to Secretary of State, which, I mean, by itself is just startling. And then, of course, we have Gina Haspel, who is the deputy CIA director, who is another, in my view, CIA director Gina Haspel, or soon to be CIA director Gina Haspel, should not be in a public office. She should be in prison for what she did. Because let's be clear, Gina Haspel was during the Bush years in charge of, I mean, this extrajudicial, unconstitutional Thailand secret prison where they took people from Germany, right? And then in black ops kind of situations, they kidnapped people from Germany. They didn't even show evidence to the Germans, right? They just took them and then they went to Thailand, right? They had to open up their gulags in these Eastern European places and put these people in and then tortured them, right? Mm-hmm. So she oversaw that, right? She and then not only that, she destroyed evidence of that, right? Which is, I mean, that's a crime. They destroyed evidence once this came to light, right? But who went to jail, right? Was it her? Was it Gina Haspel? Was it people who signed off on that? But by the way, Jim Comey signed off on that as well, right? He was the one who's a big DOJ investigator, right? The big liberal lion now, Jim Comey, who got fired by Donald Trump. Now he's some liberal hero, part of the resistance. This guy signed off on torture. This is no hero. This is no hero of the resistance. He's not even an American, in my opinion. Okay, the Eighth Amendment clearly states you can't torture people. It's unconstitutional. And these people destroyed evidence and tortured people in a very un-American, unconstitutional way, without fair trials. Right? They shouldn't be given CIA director. Instead, we're rewarding this behavior. What is this? And what are the Democrats doing? They're saying we're not going to oppose this. Chuck Schumer says, you know what? I don't really want to oppose this because I kind of actually agree, probably. Because why else would you not oppose this, right? This is the only person that is opposing this is like a few people on the left, right? The Democrats, like Dianne Feinstein and stuff like that. And then John McCain, who actually got tortured, and then Rand Paul.
Oh, yeah. Rand Paul. Threatened to once again filibuster her nomination for her torture.
Yeah, and Pompeo should be as well, because by the way, Pompeo said that we should also torture people.
Yeah, right.
These people should not be in government. These people should be in mental asylums for the kinds of things that they believe in. This is a standard practice. This is a standard thing. You do not torture people. You can't. It's unconstitutional. You can't just do that. And they did, and they got away with it.
Yeah, and it's difficult because part of this, you know, the story broke on ProPublica. They kind of did the underlying reporting, and so much of it is difficult because the transparency is just, I mean, and for good reason. These are black sites. These are CIA bases that aren't really subject to accurate reporting because they're not really supposed to exist. So the idea that there can be a national conversation on torture, it's a settled issue. It is, right?
Yeah.
As you pointed out, it is a constitutionally settled issue, and that these positions, the rhetoric surrounding it, the kind of enhanced interrogation, is all just really, I mean,
and let's be clear, it doesn't even work.
Oh, of course not. Of course it doesn't work. And that has been kind of shown, and a lot of, you know, Mattis has said on several occasions that he's against torture, just on the basis, not only on the moral basis, but on the basis that it's just not effective. It's not an effective means of gathering information. And the CIA as an institution just seems to not have that message running quite clearly through their heads. They've had a director under Obama. Who was unabashedly pro-torture in several of his interviews. And Pompeo seems to be following in that vein. And we should know that Trump follows in that vein, you know, to a T. The idea that there seems to be some outsized notion of the threat posed to American citizens by terrorism.
And let's be clear. A lot of this comes from, it has not come from a pragmatic perspective, right? Because we know that torture doesn't work. It's just because people want to torture, right? Donald Trump, during the campaign, said, we should torture people even if it doesn't work because they deserve it, okay? This is the kind of brutalism that even Dick Cheney didn't come out with saying, right? Dick Cheney said, okay, well, we got to torture people. We got to torture some people because we have to, right? But Donald Trump and his goons, like Mike Pompeo, believe that we should just torture them because they deserve it. Okay, free trial, you know, trial or any kind of evidence. No, they just torture them, waterboard them. That is, it is the kind of brutalism that it's just remarkable. And like you were mentioning, right? The Obama, right? Many of the Obama intelligence officials were involved in this torture scandal, right? Brennan defends torture, right? Mike Morrell, who was also in the intelligence agencies, he loved torture, right? He can't get enough of it. Jim Comey, who was you know, the FBI director, right? He was at the DOJ. He signed off on it, right? Robert Mueller looked the other way when he was FBI director when it came to torture. And so let's be clear. These guys are not liberal heroes. The fact that these people are part of the resistance, like John Brennan is part of the resistance because he opposes Trump, right? That's not enough, okay? You have to be opposed to un-American things like torture, which is just deeply unconstitutional. And again, who goes to jail for these kinds of things? The whistleblower who breaks out this information. John Curacao at the CIA who did this sort of thing. Chelsea Manning, a separate issue. But like all these people who are, you know, telling the stuff about unconstitutional programs, unconstitutional things that are happening in our government, they go to jail, and the people go scot-free. Obama, when he became president, he said, we should not look backwards when it came to prosecuting people for war crimes, for torture, right? We should not look backwards, we should look forwards, right? Under that logic, no crime can ever be prosecuted ever, right? Because you can never look backwards. Every crime you do, you look backwards. So if you go out and waterboard some guy, some Arab, or some Indian looking person or some person like that, because they look like it, they don't give them any trial, they don't give them any evidence, you go to jail, right? And rightfully so. But if you do it with a little CIA badge, nothing happens to you. You become the CIA director. It is absolutely absurd, and anyone who is paying attention should be understandably outraged. And I hope that Gina Haspel is not given the CIA director, and I hope that Rand Paul and Bernie Sanders and McCain and everyone speaks out against that. And the same goes with Pompeo, for that matter.
Yeah, and it's difficult because I saw an analysis in the Washington Post that essentially said, you know, going down the line, where do you trade that position for institutional knowledge? The idea that you want somebody in the CIA directorship that does have the kind of requisite institutional knowledge of the CIA, the kind of long-term skeletons in the closet, the respect of the people in the institution.
I mean, she was called Bloody Gina by people in the CIA.
Right, and where do you make that trade-off? Where do you find somebody who, I mean, because that's the point I was kind of getting at earlier, is that the CIA as an institution doesn't seem to have a clear moral stance on torture. The idea that if it works effectively a couple times, and that's the difficulty of making that argument that, you know, says torture doesn't work relative to other methods, relative to the humanitarian method of trying to extract information. Mm-hmm. And it's America is not a means justify the ends, or an ends justify the means nation. We are a nation based on constitutional rights, and these are red lines that when we cross overseas, and that's the thing, is all of these things happen overseas, and so they, you know, make a hemming and hawing argument about, oh, well, it happened over there and their laws are different. Yeah. And when it is done by American actors on, you know, perceived threats to American security for our national interest, and I'm using air quotes here, it represents a true sully to the kind of constitutional framework that we have, and it really implicates all Americans. And I mean, it's that kind of Thoreau idea of if we're all going to kind of sit there and say, oh, well, she's got the knowledge, she's got the butt torture, you know, if we're going to say, you know, she's got the smarts that we need, all of the kind of experience, so they will confirm her and just forget about the torture. It's one of those that is a fundamental, you know, ends justify the means argument. Yeah. And that's just not who we are as a nation.
And it's, I mean, even if you don't care about the moral proselytizing, right? Even if you don't care about the Eighth Amendment, which is in the Constitution, these people who consider themselves strict constitutionalists don't care at all about the Constitution. That's just remarkable, right? Even if you don't care about that, there is a practical argument, okay? In World War II, they got a bunch of high-ranking Nazi officials, right? And they brought them to the United States. And what do? Did they torture them? No, right? They brought them to steak dinners and stuff like that. Is it because they liked the Nazi criminals? No, it is not because of that. It's because when you take these people and you engage in kind of interrogation techniques where you're trying to work with them, right? You go to a steak dinner with them or you treat them nicely. They'll be like, okay, well, you seem like a nice person. Let me tell you where the U-boats are. Or recently they brought this guy who was an Al-Qaeda recruit. They just took him to a sandwich shop in New York and they gave him a pastrami sandwich and stuff like that, right? And these people tell you the accurate information. When you torture people, when you tell people to dig their own graves, right, and mock executions, they're going to say whatever they can to get out of it, right? And so that's an argument. And then, of course, when you're waterboarding someone 83 times, as one of the torture people who got tortured was, they're waterboarded 83 times, then there's an argument, okay, you're not even torturing this person for any reasonable purpose. You're just torturing them because you want to, right? Okay, that's just so excessive. And it is just shocking that that happened.
Yeah, I mean it feeds into that kind of positive feedback loop of the idea that, you know, when we do this to these people, we make examples of them. You know,
yeah.
The best argument for American ideals is America. The idea that, like, when they are shown what it means to be in this country and what it means to participate in our society, that is by far the best argument. But when we go over there and we use these methods, it engenders the same kind of hate that feeds into the cycle of Al-Qaeda propaganda and all of the kind of terrorist propaganda, the idea that we are these aggressors in their country who are passionately, you know, hateful of their, not their actions, not just their, you know, the people that are practicing these methods, as you say, seem to be extracting this pleasure. And Trump seems to be kind of in that vein of torture them because they deserve it, because they are this. It really government should be a pragmatic institution. And mm-hmm. when something doesn't work and has negative consequences on top of it, don't do it. It is not a difficult situation or a difficult answer or a call.
I mean, when you have Donald Trump, the only justification I can find for this is coming from along the lines of what Donald Trump said during the campaign, where he was like, okay, well, ISIS, they chop off heads. We can't even waterboard them. They chop off heads. We can't even waterboard them. First of all, people we know, like Saudi Arabia, they chop off heads all the time. So that's nothing. But second of all, yes, ISIS is different from the U.S. on a moral level. The idea that we are going to stoop to the level of ISIS because they chop off heads, we can't. What kind of? I mean, they're a terrorist organization that we're not supposed to stoop down to their level. We're not supposed to, like. So are we supposed to chop off heads because they're chopping off heads? Is this a race to the bottom of morality? Are we supposed to be on the same level as them? Okay, that doesn't work. And then also you mentioned, right? This is going to be counterproductive. The terrorists will use this in their propaganda, right? Oh, they're torturing people. Look at CIA Director Mike Pompeo, who believes that this is a war against Christianity and Islam. Look at what Donald Trump says when he says Islam hates us. You think this is going to help? This is why people who are reasonable people in the intelligence agencies, like Mattis, who at least, I mean, he's a right-wing general. He's crazy for his own reasons. He wants war with Iran. At least he understands. You cannot alienate an entire religion. You cannot alienate an entire people. You cannot torture people, because he's a pragmatist. He understands that if we're going to win this, you know, this war on terror, which, by the way, I find already flawed,
of course,
then we need to have allies in that area. We need to not brutally torture people because they might be terrorists. So it's. I mean, we I don't want to move on to the McCabe firing because I think it is related, but when you look at the people, and now when you look at what Trump is wanting to do, right? He wants to get rid of H.R. McMaster and replace him with John Bolton. John Bolton is one of the most craziest people in the United States. He said that he wanted to blow up like the first 10 stories of the United Nations. He was like, if you do that, then nothing matters. It doesn't matter. The United Nations is a ridiculous institution. This is while he was ambassador to the United Nations, right? He is a extreme neoconservative who is about as right wing as you can get, right? He was considered by the Bush administration to be to an extreme, right? So this is who they want to replace as the national security advisor instead of H.R. McMaster, who, by the way, they don't need any confirmation, so that's a freebie. So right. Trump can do that, and he wants to get rid of right H.R. McMaster. And then he's putting Mike Pompeo in at Secretary of State, and then you have CIA Director Haspel, right? So he's stacking his deck with the same kinds of warmongers that Hillary Clinton was accused of doing, right? When the election was happening, I had a lot of my liberal friends and people who were still undecided. They were like, okay, well, Hillary Clinton is the more hawkish candidate, right? That is clearly what we can see now is that Donald Trump has just fallen down, just bent over backwards for the deep state, so-called, and has become essentially a extreme hawk. And year two of the Trump administration, at least foreign policy-wise, does not look comforting.
Yep.
And so, anyways, I want to move on to the McCabe firing, because that's also interesting. So Andrew McCabe was fired. He was number two at the FBI. He was a disciple of Comey's. He was involved in the Russian investigation. He was actually going to be a witness for Mueller's investigation. There's a lot of criticism that McCabe faced from Donald Trump and the administration. So, for example, Donald Trump had tweeted out many times about his ire towards Andrew McCabe. One of the reasons was because Andrew McCabe's wife was a Democrat who had given a bunch of money to Democrats, and she had run as a Democrat, I think. So he thought there was some conflict of interest in the FBI, and he was using Andrew McCabe sort of as a tool to attack the FBI. And then, of course, 26 hours before McCabe turns 50, when he becomes eligible for pensions, because he was planning to retire, right? He gets fired in a very, you know, showman-like way, and that's plastered across all the media, because, of course, they view it as this kind of part of the Russian investigation. They're firing people who are instrumental in the Russian investigation. Now, the reason that Jeff Sessions cited, because remember, Trump can't fire him, right? So Jeff Sessions has to fire him, and Jeff Sessions did. The reason Jeff Sessions fired him is because they cited the Office of Professional Responsibility at the FBI. Now, the Office of Professional Responsibility at the FBI is run by an Obama appointee, okay? So, and they concluded that what Andrew McCabe had done during the Clinton investigation, before the election, was a lack of candor. Because what he did was he called the Wall Street Journal and he told them a bunch of information about the Clinton investigation, right? And this was after the Wall Street Journal had published an article about his wife and her ties to the Democratic Party, right? And so what I find so interesting about this and so remarkable is that they're firing McCabe over something that hurt Clinton, that he did break conduct and he did do something that was wrong. And the Office of Professional Responsibility, run by Obama, an Obama appointee, found that, yes, he should be fired on these grounds. But it was because he was helping Trump and he was hurting Clinton.
Yeah, well, it's difficult. So there's a kind of kabuki theater aspect to this, the idea that the Trump administration, in theory, is holding to this Office of Professional Responsibility argument, the idea that McCabe showed a lack of candor. And I think I believe it was Today Explained, Vox's wonderful podcast, that kind of delved into this, that lack of candor at the FBI is like by far the worst possible thing.
Yeah.
People get kind of suspended but keep their jobs when they lose their gun. And you know, I think a lot of that is the kind of Boy Scout mentality that a lot of people associate with the FBI. But lack of candor typically means that you're done at the FBI, and that it's a kind of burn bridges situation.
Yeah, and I was reading a FBI insider who had, she was named the Time Person of the Year. She had talked about the 9/11, the FBI's misconduct before 9/11 and how they knew about stuff. She has a blog, right? And she talked about Andrew McCabe's firing. And she said, I mean, even though I personally believe that lack of candor is, I mean, the fact that he talked to some press briefing about the investigation, and he didn't really disclose any classified information. He just sort of said certain things that were known.
Right.
That is a huge problem in the FBI, an institutional problem. But then she also mentioned, you know, there is a double standard. And typically most people who are the senior agents who kind of do this kind of thing for political purposes, they don't get prosecuted by the OPR. But McCabe was, and that's a good sign. And so I don't know really what to think of this, because on the one hand, obviously he was a bad apple and he did do a bad thing. I mean, he was helping Trump, though, so which is confusing. But on the other hand, they are clearly firing him not because of that. It's because they want to sort of, stop his, smear his character.
Right.
Because remember that he's going to go in front of, he's going to be part of the Mueller investigation. And when he's called as a witness, because he does have, I think he said he has notes. He took notes of his meetings, yeah, right? Memos, right? When he goes in front of the Mueller investigation, what they're going to say is, look at Andrew McCabe. I mean, this guy was, we fired him because he was breaking lack of candor.
Mm-hmm.
And so this guy is not trustworthy and we should not consider him. And the same will go for Comey. They'll try to do that, the impugn his character in that way. And obviously, I'm not going to defend Andrew McCabe and Jim Comey. But, I mean, politically, I don't agree with them at all. And what they've done is, what Jim Comey did especially was un-American in my view. But it's clear that this is a political thing, not a, you know, idea, but more ideas thing.
Right. Yeah. That's the second part of that equation. The idea that behind the facade of the official lack of candor response to this is the kind of Trump tweet political situation. When I think it was about 90 days ago. So about 3 months ago, Trump was tweeting something along the lines of, don't get too comfortable, McCabe. Don't count on that pension. And the real, it's one thing that I've been kind of concerned about is how much more of the indignity of Trump's attitudes towards high FBI officials can the intelligence community take. You know, a lot of the situations that you talk about, the idea that the OPR does not really go after high-level officials for an offense like this. But one thing that I saw is that when it does, typically they're allowed to resign with kind of...
with grace, yeah, right? Yeah.
And so the intelligence community seems to be condemnatory of his actions, but equally as condemnatory as of Trump's... treatment of a position or a person in his position of his authority in the FBI. And that just goes into the same kind of vein as what Trump did with concerns to Comey. And so I just don't know how much more fraying the relationship between the justice or the intelligence and justice community and President Trump can take, which this situation certainly exacerbates.
I mean, I'm just so confused at this whole situation, because on the one hand, you have Trump going after people who are part of this Russia investigation, right? And Mueller is ever expanding his sort of his reach on it. And I don't want to, like, you know, speculate a lot on what's happening there, but like he's looking into, you know, the Trump businesses now and Russian laundering and things like that. And on one hand, you have Trump really adamantly opposed to that, right? And then he was also really not he was not on board with the Russian sanctions. The Senate approved that overwhelmingly. He didn't want to implement that,
right?
But on the other hand, you have people in his administration, and you have kinds of things that he's done in the past that seem to go against this whole pro-Russia stance, right? So, for example, he has Mike Pompeo and other such people who think that Russia is some horrible agent and a lot of these neoconservatives in his government who believe that Russia is some serious problem. And then he recently put sanctions on Russia for the poisoning.
Right.
Which, by the way, I mean, in regards to that, I mean, just briefly, that there was a poisoning of this Russian double agent in the UK, Salisbury, right? And the UK government has sort of said, well, we don't really know for certain if it was the Russian government or if it was the Russian government leaked this nerve agent that got into the hands of mobsters that did this, but we're going to go ahead and sanction the Russian government.
Yeah.
And so, and then when Jeremy Corbyn at the Labour Party says, hey, can the UK public see the evidence? Can the Russian government get a sample of this poison to look at to see if it was theirs? I mean, that's what you do. You give a suspect the evidence, so you show them the evidence. Can the UK government, can the UK public see this? Maybe we shouldn't rush to conclusions. He's deemed this Russian agent, right? And so, you know, I have mixed views on the Salisbury situation because, you know, and the whole Russia, like, thing, because we need to see evidence, I think, before. Well, I mean, people thought that Russia hacked the election. They hacked the boots. There was no evidence for that. And now it's become this thing of, okay, well, maybe Cambridge Analytica took some Facebook data and messed around with it.
Yeah, well, it's so I think we'll probably move into the Cambridge Analytica part. But one lovely bit of that kind of story, the Salisbury poisoning story, is that when asked for official comment, the kind of comment from the Kremlin is, we had no motive. So was not a flat denial. We didn't kill him. It's just like, I can't see why we would want to poison an agent
which
is actively, you know, a double agent or was, you know, an active double agent previously.
I mean, it makes some sense that what motive do they have to sort of alienate the UK and the US for, I mean, I don't know directly. I mean, obviously he's a double agent.
And right. I mean, right. And it's like retroactively. So the idea that like he's not a present and, or from all accounts that we know, he was not a present danger because he was not an active.
And so what you know, it's interesting. Also the UK story, right? Jeremy Corbyn of the Labour Party, he's called this Russian agent, right? And he's called, okay, because he doesn't want to immediately come to the Cold War II with Russia, right? And he attacked the Conservative Party because the UK is very well known for being this big spot for Russian money laundering. Mm-hmm. Oligarchs pour their money into London and other places, and no one asks any questions. UK doesn't ask any questions. The Conservative Party has gotten hundreds of thousands of pounds in donations from the Russian oligarchs. And Jeremy Corbyn was saying, look, if you're going to sanction Russia over this, let's do some meaningful action. Let's go after the Russian oligarchs who are funding your party. And of course, they didn't. They're sort of backing away from that, right? Anyways, so I wanted to move to the Cambridge Analytica story too, because that's another interesting thing where people have had the wrong view of it, right? So Cambridge Analytica is obviously a horrible actor, right? They say that they entrap politicians. Like, there's this Channel 4 expose in the UK where they got these two Cambridge Analytica guys who said, yeah, we use, you know, sort of really illicit sort of means. We blackmail people. We entrap politicians in sex scandals and other such things to sort of get our way, right? But the real problem within the United States is that Cambridge Analytica used Facebook data, right? Cambridge Analytica used Facebook data from a bunch of people that took some personality test, and they took that information and it used it to give targeted ads, right?
Yeah, well, it's a difficult situation to kind of parse out. So the idea is that the real bad faith action that Cambridge Analytica took in terms of this data was the acquisition of the data. Facebook does not license the sale of personal data to companies that are going to use it for ads or companies who are going to use it for kind of political targeting. And so the roundabout that Cambridge Analytica used, because they were up against a wall, because Robert Mercer and a couple of other conservative funders were asking for a kind of proof of concept from them. And so they didn't have the raw data to back up their claims. They went to a British scientist, a Russian-American, or a British professor, sorry, a Russian-American individual. I'm going to forget his last name. But
Alexander something, right?
Yeah, Dr. Alexander, right? Spelled with just DR, so very Russian-American. But
Dr. Alexander Kogan, who apparently briefly changed his name to Dr. Spectre.
Dr. Spectre, interesting. So
Spectre, like the Bond.
Right, of course, yeah.
Well,
so perhaps a Bond villain or Austin Powers villain, whichever way you view it. you know, the idea is that they licensed this information to him for academic purposes, and he sold it to Cambridge Analytica in a bad faith practice, which violated Facebook's terms of service. And so it's not in any way illegal technically. But it does violate the Facebook terms and services, and they have removed both Cambridge Analytica and that British professor. So, in terms of effect on America, we're lacking the concrete details of how this data was used in political targeting, but the idea behind it is something called psychographics. The kind of melding of psychological traits and personality traits into a profile that can be used to kind of target psychological weaknesses. And so the kind of example I saw online was that you sell a kind of unnecessarily high-tech home security system to someone who's neurotic and paranoid.
Yikes.
And so it's difficult to parse out because we have a system of emotional micro-targeting in campaigns, or not campaigns, sorry, advertisement already. The idea that, like, you get ads based on your search history, based on your profile traits, based on kind of things that you have searched in the past, or liked in the past on Facebook, but that's all raw data, and that's all kind of, you can't tell who that is. You can just kind of tell, like, oh, she liked Yosemite Park, whatever, yeah. And so you advertise hiking boots. But this is predicated on this idea that emotions and our kind of personality makeup is this insurmountable barrier that represents the kind of short circuit of the rational function, so that when it's used in political ads, it's so compelling and so subversive to the rational actor that it represents like a bad faith act because, you know, it doesn't give them the chance to vote on the merits of the candidate.
Yeah.
That argument doesn't hold a lot of weight to me. The idea that, oh, I've seen the compelling Facebook ad, that's, yeah, I guess that's the ball game. I think that we put a lot of stock in the idea that emotions are this conditioned reaction that we cannot control, and that doesn't seem to hold weight for me. The idea that I think emotions are a conditioned response to concepts that we have formed, and concepts can be changed. So when we're condemning these ads, condemning the use of this psychographic data, what we're really saying is that people, voters, aren't smart enough to see the attack on their personality makeup or their and overcome that with kind of an analysis of you know, the candidate's merits. And so I don't give this story a lot of kind of causal weight in the determination of the 2016 outcome, and that to me is the only way that I see we should really care about this. Other than that, it is a violation of Facebook's terms and services, which, you know, they're a private company, they can take their own actions on it.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of things to say. First of all, this story is not new. I mean, I remember reading about this in 2015. The Intercept and The Guardian had published stuff about this. The Intercept had, but with Glenn Greenwald, his publication, they had published an article in 2015 claiming that Cambridge Analytica was harvesting millions of users' data for the Ted Cruz presidential campaign. So this is not new information, right? And it is, albeit this is a different situation, but I remember Time Magazine in 2011, I think it was, 2012, gleefully noting the Obama campaign using similar tactics of asking people to submit data from Facebook and taking data and sort of collating that and using that as sort of a way to help reelect Obama, right? Now there is a difference because there's a level of transparency there because Obama's campaign thing was voluntary and people knew what they were getting themselves into. But this Facebook thing wasn't, right? But yes, like I agree that I don't know how much weight it has in the 2016 election. I don't know the exact, I mean, people say that, oh, you know, this is Russian interference in our election. Yes, I mean, first of all, Cambridge Analytica is a, I assume that there is probably going to be some Russian connection. Yes, it's not inconceivable that it happened, right? But, you know, the idea that that is one of several factors for what happened in the 2016 election. I don't think that even the Mueller investigation, I don't think that is going to necessarily find much in the terms of Russian interference by like Facebook and other such means, but more of the laundering and the business ties that Trump has to Russia.
Right, yeah.
I think that there's some sort of smoke there.
That's, of course, the substance of the...
Yeah, with Kushner and Trump and having business ties in Russia and a lot of long history with Russian oligarchs and Russian mobsters. That's something that I think that they're just now getting into, right? Which is not as interesting as the Manchurian candidate, Russian interference, sort of Cold War kind of thing that people have been alleging. But this is an interesting story, I think, in Facebook and the privacy rights that Facebook has been just able to just run rampant with. You know, it is a private company, that is true, but it has been not transparent at all with the kinds of things it does with people's data. And it does need some oversight, but I don't think that the oversight that we're getting now is out of good faith. It's because people are politically motivated and they want to go after Facebook because Mark Zuckerberg helped Donald Trump in the election. I mean, the FTC is now investigating Facebook. Dianne Feinstein and wants Mark Zuckerberg to come and testify in the committee hearings. Like, this is preposterous. I mean, yes, Facebook is responsible for a lot, like for looking at this, and they should have done this sooner. They should have looked at Cambridge Analytica sooner. And maybe there is evidence to show that they knew about this, but they kept letting it happen. And there is a thing about data protection, right? They do make agreements about data protection with users and the fact that users' data can't just be used for whatever sort of nefarious purpose that they want to. But in terms of Russian interference, you know, I mean, Cambridge Analytica is a very interesting story about this kind of company that's using really, really sick ways to get politicians to do their bidding. But I don't think in terms of Russian interference, it's as... And also Bob Mercer, Robert Mercer. Oh, my God. That guy is everywhere in every single story about nefarious things. That guy, he never goes away.
So he really saw this as like a way of making himself the kind of puppet master of Republican politics. The idea that with the data analytics of this firm in his pocket, he could subvert the rational function of Americans, which tells them that Republicans are not great candidates for office by and large.
Just to be clear, Bob Mercer is, for people that don't know, he was part of Renaissance Technologies, which is a giant hedge fund. He's a billionaire, number one donor to Republicans. He also funded Breitbart, I believe.
I think, I want to say I saw an article that says he surpassed Koch for the Koch network for a brief moment. But
he gave, I think, $15 million to Donald Trump's campaign. So this guy is a right-wing billionaire who has been using his capital to spend a lot of money in politics. And, you know, he's done a pretty good job, as you can tell.
Yeah, and so the kind of narrow focus here on Cambridge Analytica, it's difficult because, you know, we talk about what should Facebook do. If an actor is intent on violating the terms and services of Facebook, does that, you know, constitute a freeing of Facebook from any culpability? The idea that, you know, are terms and services enough for a private company in terms of data protection. And those are some interesting questions. I probably am not terribly well-versed enough to go after those. But what I will say is that, and something that I've seen a lot of people framing it as, is this is another one of those ways that we try to understand the seemingly incomprehensible way that Donald Trump got elected, or the seeming incomprehensibility of Donald Trump winning an election in America. The idea that, oh, it must have been a subversion of the, kind of like a psychological warfare subversion of the people's will. And, you know, we want to blame that on Russia. We want to blame that on psychological targeted ads. At the end of the day, I think those are harmful to a more meaningful, more truthful understanding of what happened in the election and what continues to be problems that are going to persist in America. The idea that we don't have a great way of dealing with disaffected people that have been affected by globalization. The idea that we don't have a good message for what it's almost one of these issues is we don't have a we've distanced ourselves from the kind of understanding of the way that identities should work together in America. The idea that, you know, we've played so much with identity politics that we've fragmented the country. And so I focus on stuff like Cambridge Analytica, focus on the kind of Russian interference, is valuable in its own right, but shouldn't be used to supplant or to kind of overtake the narrative of the actual, true stories of the 2016 election and the people that were affected and the reasons, the underlying rational reasons, reasons that Donald Trump's campaign were effective, or was effective, rather. And so, yeah, I think a focus on this is an interesting way of looking at Facebook, but not a particularly helpful way of looking at the 2016 election.
Yeah, I mean, this whole Russia situation, I think, is a perfect way for Democrats to do what's called fake resistance. Mm-hmm. They'll say, the reason Donald Trump won is because Russia interfered, right? That is one reason, okay? Another reason is because Hillary Clinton was a terrible candidate.
Oh, yeah, terrible campaign.
Terrible campaign, didn't even go to Wisconsin and stuff like that. And the Democrats are just, when they claim to be the resistance against Donald Trump, this is what really irritates me, because they are supposed to be the opposition party, right? If you're against Trump, you should be looking at the Democrats for opposition, right? Let's talk about what the Democrats are doing right now. Let's move on in the brief time we have to what they have been doing in the face of all this, NRA opposition, right? The opposition, the whole high school walkouts. My sister was a part of one of them, right? There were hundreds of thousands of students that walked out of school in order to protest the whole NRA thing, right? And then what are the Democrats doing in spite of that? What is Congress doing? They're not doing any action on the gun situation. Right. They wanted to work with Trump, and then Trump said he might help the Democrats with their assault weapon ban. He was giving mixed messages on that. And then he obviously takes the most right wing position, which is we should arm teachers.
Yeah.
So the Democrats were conned there, too. OK, well, what are they doing about DACA? Right. They said that they were not going to negotiate the omnibus package, the budget without a deal for Dreamers.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what? Nancy Pelosi's backing away from that. The Dreamers are left out. In the dust, right? So these are the kinds of cowardly Democrats we have as opposition, right? They don't oppose Mike Pompeo and Gina Haspel, right? Chuck Schumer is saying, I'm not pushing Democrats to go and oppose that directly. Okay, well, what kind of opposition are you then, right? And then another thing, right? So this banking bill that they recently passed, which deregulates the financial industry, right? 17 Democrats voted for it, okay? So what happened was that the Senate has passed this bill that is going to exempt 25 of America's biggest banks from regulation, which was created after 2008, right? Dodd-Frank was what happened, right? And Dodd-Frank said that anything with assets above 50 billion is going to be considered systemically at risk. And so there were some leverage constraints and things like that. These were all band-aids. Right. At the time, it was considered a band-aid, this huge problem of the financial sector, right? And so what the Democrats have said, and what the Republicans, all the Republicans voted unanimously for this, 17 Democrats voted for it, right? They said, you know what, let's exempt 25 of America's biggest banks, JP Morgan. Let's say you're not under these sort of financial constraints, right? And so this, and they passed it, right? And the CBO said, the CBO, which is a nonpartisan organization, said the financial crisis, the risk of another financial crisis, quote, would be greater under the legislation, and that it would cost taxpayers $671 million, and it would add to the deficit over the next 10 years. Mm. So tell me again about the deficit spending and how they care about the deficit,
yeah,
right?
Of course.
So part of the legislation would allow JP Morgan Chase and Citibank, two of the very biggest banks in the U.S., to hold less capital relative to their assets, which is kind of preventing the, which is one of the safety measures they have to avoid speculation. And also it gets rid of these consumer protections, which like lead to discrimination, right? So that you can't discriminate for certain loans and things like that.
Yeah. Well, it's difficult because the kind of framers of the original Dodd-Frank bill recognized that the $50 billion cap was probably too low for, you know, Frank himself said it should be somewhere in the $125 billion range. And that's simply because those banks don't have the kind of legal resources to deal with the burdens of compliance that the larger banks do. And that's a completely valid argument.
And it's $250 billion.
Right. So, of course. You know, they raised it far above where Frank would have wanted it, and far above where a lot of people were saying it should be, and kind of brought it into the situation where two or three banks of these banks that are no longer systemically, SIFI is the acronym,
yeah,
systemically important financial institutions, two or three of these banks fail, and we're back at the kind of 2008 level bankruptcy we saw.
And why are the Democrats, why are the 17 Democrats on board with this? It's because, as always, I mean, the Reuters touted this as some bipartisan achievement. Yeah, it's a bipartisan achievement when you buy the partisanship, which is what the banks have done, okay? The average supporter of this bill gets $277,000 from banks, credit unions, and other industries that would benefit from this legislation, right? So when you talk about cronyism, this is the kind of cronyism people are talking about, right? Democrats in a week where gun rights and immigration and issues that matter to the base are important and they want action on, they're going around defending giving billions of dollars to JP Morgan, right? Because they get hundreds of thousands of dollars of campaign contributions. This is the kind of resistance we can expect from the Democratic Party.
Yeah, and we shouldn't ignore some of the things that I think this bill does, if not well, because Congress rarely does anything well, it does in the right direction. The idea of banks who give out less than 500 or 500 or less mortgages per year don't have to comply with the same kind of discriminatory mortgage regulations that the other banks do. You know, I worked in a small bank when I was in Victoria. These places handle a relatively high amount of assets, but aren't kind of in the same playing field as banks that have legal resources to comply with all these onerous restrictions. And because these are community banks, their board, their leadership are particularly susceptible to community influence. And so discriminatory practices by these banks tend to not be a bit of a non-starter because the community, you know, wouldn't allow it. And it's difficult, and the 500 mortgages per year seem to be an arbitrary number by all accounts. But it's a step in the right direction for some of the banks that struggle from these compliance laws. And then the Volcker rule, the idea that banks with under $10 billion in assets can now use speculatory investments. I'm not particularly well-versed on this issue, but that troubles me in a very kind of fundamental way. I was under the investment management branch of the bank that I worked at, and my boss ended up leaving because of the kind of strict regulatory framework and the kind of regulatory loopholes that she had to go through because simply because her investment management was attached to the bank, you know, not mm-hmm. for any reason yeah. that she was managing some high amount of asset. It was just because she was under the management of the bank. And so those effects really do, they're there and they're real for, you know, a handful of small community banks. And so those narrow policies step in the right direction. Towards the yeah. broader bill, you know, obviously it's got some issues.
What I think is, look, the community banks, yes, there is something to be said about big, there are a lot of community banks that manage a lot of money, but don't have a lot of clientele, right? But they are using that as a mask to allow financial institutions that were largely responsible for the 2008 crash. I mean, we just had a crash. You know, and the CBO is saying this bill, you have to tweak this bill so that it doesn't affect it. And in regards to the discrimination thing, the discrimination practices, there is an argument to be made that, yes, certain banks don't have to deal with the kinds of regulations regarding discrimination. But I would like to see the evidence that, you know, that there is, you know, that they don't need these regulations, right? And so... you know, we have 4 minutes left. So in the brief time we have, I do think that, you know, when we talk about resistance to Trump's agenda, we expect the Democrats to do something about it, and instead what they're doing is voting for this kind of banking bill because they're bought by the kinds of people, right? So if anything, I think today's lesson is that whether you look at the UT administration or the government at large, it is just, I mean, I don't know what else to call it, corruption or just a lack of care for their constituents or their students or whatever.
Yeah, well, poorly spent funds seem to be a place where you and I can both kind of...
Sure, that's a very diplomatic way to say.
Stamp on the effigy of institutions writ large. We're wrapping up here. So listeners, I hope all your Daniels are quite stormy this week. And that all of you have a great week dealing with the heap of work that professors seem to have think that... I was telling this to Anurag in the beginning.
Yeah.
The idea that they seem to have just... taken a week's worth of work from spring break and like dumped it over to the next week, or that has been my experience. So good luck dealing with that.
Yeah, good luck. That's all I can really say. I mean, yeah, you're on your own on that one.
Right.
All right, see ya.